Hey everyone, you're listening to the Authors of Mass Destruction podcast with fiction author and national security expert Natasha Bajma. Join me as I interview subject matter experts about weapons of mass destruction and emerging technologies and authors who write about them. We'll discuss the ethical, societal, and technical aspects of science and technology so that you can tell great stories and still get the details right. Welcome to episode number 4 of the Authors of Mass Destruction podcast. My name is Natasha Bajma, aka WMD Girl on Twitter. I'm a fiction author, national security expert, and your host for this podcast. If you're tuning in for the first time, welcome to the show. I started this podcast to help authors write great stories while getting the technical details right. So if you're interested in science and technology, in reading good fiction, or want to write fiction based on technology, you're in the right place. Before we get started, a few notes. The views expressed on this podcast are my own and do not reflect the official policy or position of the National Defense University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. The Authors of Mass Destruction podcast is proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Check us out at www.authorsontheair.com. Okay, let's talk tech news. My headline for this week is a bit morbid, and for that, I apologize. The headline is, Mother Charged with Murder 38 Years After Allegedly Leaving Newborn in a Ditch, published on NBC News on March 8. The only reason I found this headline is that Google News knows me better than I know myself. At first glance, I didn't know why this one made my news feed. I shuddered, but I clicked on it because I can't help myself. So what happened here? Well, it was a cold case, 38 years old. A baby was left in a ditch in 1981 and died of exposure to cold weather. Shudder. This was long before our capability to sequence DNA and identify suspects from trace material. Several years ago, law enforcement authorities exhumed the baby's body and took DNA samples. A few months ago, authorities worked with a DNA technology company and found several family trees that possibly connected the baby to residents in Sioux Falls. One of them was a match with a woman believed to be the child's grandmother. During the investigation, the detectives acquired a DNA sample from Teresa Rose Bentis, age 57, and they determined her to be the baby's mother. She was arrested last week and charged with first and second degree murder and first degree manslaughter. So why do I find this fascinating? Because it's indicative of the new world we're living in. More and more people are sending in their DNA to companies to find out about their genetic ancestry. Personally, I don't think it's worth it. I think the compromise to privacy for the type of information you get back, which is not solidly based on science, more of an art, is not worth the price you pay. Many of these same people upload their profiles to free online genealogy databases to find long-lost relatives. Again, not something that I would recommend, not something that I will be doing. Last year, police used such a database to catch the Golden State Killer. You can read about it in the news. There are so many fascinating fiction stories that could be written about these topics. In fact, I used this topic in my second novel, Project Gecko. My main character is able to figure out the identity of a suspect by loading up his DNA profile into such a database, finding the family tree, and then narrowing down on the suspect. If you find this interesting, there are a few other headlines to check out. On April 27, 2018, on CNN, police used free genealogy database to track Golden State Killer suspect, investigator says. Second headline, the DNA technique that caught the Golden State Killer is more powerful than we thought. That was published on TheVerge.com on October 11, 2018. Finally, if you'd like a more scientific piece, identity inference, see it's scientific, of genomic data using long-range familial searches in Science magazine in November 2018. In that article, scientists suggest that nearly an entire population could be identified using a small base of samples. Definitely worth a read if you like science sort of stuff. All right, no guest interview today. I'm kicking off my first episode of Nuclear 101 for writers, students, and technology nerds. My first lecture will be on the basics of the atom. For the past 10 years, I've taught military and civilian leaders across the US government about weapons of mass destruction. In my classroom, I like to tell stories using a combination of science, history, international relations, with a dash of pop culture here and there. Rather than razzle-dazzle you with my IQ, I'm going to tell you exactly what you need to know to write your story, to understand basic physics, and explain it in the simplest terms possible. So there's no need to stress out, and there's nothing wrong with a layman's understanding of advanced science technology. Trust me, I worked in the Pentagon for 3 years advising senior leaders with my basic understanding. I'm not a hard scientist, but I know enough about nuclear physics to get by. So we're going to get a bit technical. But my promise to you is this. If you stick with me through these technical modules, you'll know everything you need to know to write an incredible story about nuclear weapons. And you might know enough to advise senior leaders. And who knows, maybe you'll have impact at the highest levels of government, whether through fiction or policy. Welcome to Nuclear 101 for writers, students, and technology nerds. Chapter 1 is titled Atomic Matters, and today we'll begin with a segment called The Basics of the Atom. At the end of this segment, you'll understand the following: some basic terminology, the structure of the atom, the importance of neutrons and isotopes, the key starting ingredient for nuclear weapons, and the first reason why it's so hard to develop bomb material. If you stick with me through this segment, your scientist characters will definitely sound like they know what they're talking about. That's worth learning about nuclear physics, right? Okay, let's begin. Nuclear weapons depend on the energy that can be released from the nuclei of atoms. So we have to start at the beginning. All matter which occupies space and has mass, whether it's a solid, a liquid, or a gas, is made up of atoms, or some combination of atoms. Nuclear physics is the study of the properties of the atomic nucleus, and that is why we need a basic understanding of the atom. The word atom comes from the Greek language and means uncuttable or indivisible. It was first used by the ancient Greek philosopher Democritus to describe the smallest unit of matter. He theorized that all matter consisted of fundamental, indivisible, and unchangeable objects. It was a controversial theory at the time and eventually became accepted as fact, at least until the late 1800s. He was gravely wrong on all counts, and that's where nuclear physics comes in. To understand the basics of the atom, let's travel back in time to the dawn of nuclear physics in the late 1800s and early 1900s to examine some of the work conducted at the earliest nuclear physics laboratories, which were located in the United Kingdom, Germany, and Denmark. In the early years, Europe represented the center of excellence for the field of nuclear physics. Until the mid-1920s, Americans paid little attention to the esoteric study of the atom, and that's somewhat ironic given that the United States was the first country to win the race to develop the bomb. Even Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the American bomb, studied nuclear physics in England and Germany and took what he learned back to the University of California at Berkeley. The story of how the field of nuclear physics got started in Europe and culminated with the atomic bomb in the United States under the Manhattan Project is a fascinating one, which I plan to cover in later segments. All right, in the late 1800s, scientists were making inquiries into the structure of the atom and exploring it as a source of energy. One element of interest was uranium. So let's go a little bit back in time. Uranium was discovered in 1789 by a German chemist, Martin Heinrich Klaproth. He found it in the mineral called pitchblende, and he named it after the recently discovered planet Uranus. In its natural state, uranium is a solid and a metal, and was not considered anything special at the time of its discovery. Much later in time, scientists discovered that there were 92 naturally occurring elements, and that uranium was the heaviest of them. But it wasn't until 1896, more than 100 years after the discovery of uranium, that Antoine-Henri Becquerel, a French physicist, detected a form of energy emanating from a uranium sample, which was later called radioactivity. Okay, let's put a pin in this for now, and we'll talk about radioactivity in the next segment. Let's go back to the study of the atom. Nuclear physicists were determined to discover the secrets of the atom. In 1897, J.J. Thomson discovered the electron, a negatively charged subatomic particle. It was called subatomic because it resides within a neutrally charged atom. This discovery was a profound breakthrough for the field of nuclear physics because it overturned the idea that the atom was the smallest unit of matter. And it turns out there are several different types of subatomic particles that are important for our understanding of nuclear weapons. We're going to talk about two more of these. But before we do, let's think back to grade school and playing with magnets as a kid. What repels positive? Positive. And negative repels negative. Because scientists knew atoms had a neutral charge when they discovered electrons, which were negatively charged, scientists assumed there must be a positively charged counterpart to the electron. That makes sense, right? If the total charge of the atom is neutral, then there would have to be equal parts of positive parts and negative parts. But it wasn't until 20 years later, in 1919, that Ernest Rutherford, a New Zealander by birth, he was a student of J.J. Thomson and working at the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge, the United Kingdom, he discovered and named the positively charged subatomic particle, and he named it a proton. But long before that, Rutherford had discovered the existence of the atom's nucleus. In 1911, he proposed that the entire mass of the atom was concentrated into a tiny core, 99.9% of the mass, and that that core carried a positive charge. He tested this hypothesis with an experiment in which he passed positively charged alpha particles through the atom. A small portion of these alpha particles were deflected, indicating a small concentrated positively charged core at the center of the atom, the nucleus. A few years later, in 1913, Niels Bohr, a Danish scientist, posited the structure of the atom consisting of protons, which are positively charged, and electrons, negatively charged. His model depicted the atom as a small positively charged nucleus, surrounded by electrons that travel in circular orbits around the nucleus. Because electrons are attracted to the positively charged nucleus, they are bound in these orbits or shells. Are you still with me? Before we go a little bit further, you want to hear something exciting? If this tidbit doesn't convince you to keep reading and get the technical details right in your fiction, I don't know what would. Nuclear weapons were first referred to as atomic bombs because they harnessed the energy contained within the atom. The term atomic bomb was coined by the British science fiction writer, H.G. Wells, in his 1914 science fiction novel entitled The World Set Free. The author was closely following the developments in the nascent field of nuclear physics in the early 1900s and the scientific debates about the potential of one day tapping the energy stored within the atom. In fact, he got the idea for his novel from reading British nuclear physicist Friedrich Soddy's nonfiction book written in 1909 called The Interpretation of Radium. Sounds pretty page-turner, right? To nuclear physicists of the time, the prospect of getting energy out from the atom felt like the distant future. It was the stuff of great science fiction novels. In The World Set Free, published in 1914, H.G. Wells portrays a nuclear war taking place in the world in 1956, devastating many of its major cities. In fact, if you look in the front cover, H.G. Wells dedicated the book to British nuclear physicist Friedrich Soddy. We'll come back to him later. Well, Wells coined the term atomic bomb. It was President Harry Truman who introduced the term on the world stage in 1945 after a B-29 bomber delivered its first nuclear weapon called Little Boy on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. Here's a quote from President Truman's speech. 16 hours ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima, an important Japanese army base. That bomb had more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. It is an atomic bomb. It is a harnessing of the basic power of the universe. The force from which the sun draws its power has been loosed against those who brought war to the Far East. Okay, let's review. We've talked about the atom, which is not the smallest unit of matter. We've also discussed the existence of two subatomic particles, the negatively charged electron and the positively charged proton. But we have yet to talk about the most important subatomic particle for nuclear weapons. It is the key to unlocking the energy within the atom. In 1932, British scientist James Chadwick discovered the neutrally charged neutron located inside the nucleus, right next to protons. This discovery sent ripples through the scientific community. Without a charge, it had the capability of penetrating the positively charged nucleus to release the energy stored within. Now, why have I told you all of this? We're almost there, I promise. Remember the periodic table from high school chemistry class? That chart that lists the chemical elements in order by their atomic number? That's the total number of protons in a nucleus. Although the atom is not the smallest unit of matter, it is the smallest unit of a chemical element. An element is defined as a substance that cannot be broken down any further without changing its chemical properties. Before we continue, let's talk briefly about the difference between chemical and physical properties. This distinction is important for understanding the basic concepts underlying nuclear weapons. Physical properties are those that can be observed or measured without changing a substance. These are color, melting point, boiling point, density, mass, volume, conductivity, and shape. In contrast, chemical properties may be observed only by changing the substance or conducting a chemical reaction. These include flammability, reactivity, acidity, toxicity, and radioactivity. But there's a third category of characteristics that matter for understanding nuclear weapons, and these are nuclear characteristics. They're based on the element's tendency to undergo nuclear reactions. And these are changes at the nuclear level, such as fission, neutron absorption, and radioactive decay. Don't worry, we'll get to all those later. The key difference between a chemical and a nuclear reaction comes down to mass and energy. During chemical reactions, there is no change in mass, so no loss or gain. During nuclear reactions, there is a loss in mass as a portion is converted into energy. Okay, back to the periodic table and atomic numbers. Atoms of different chemical elements have different numbers of protons. That number gives them their distinct chemical properties. Different elements are identified by their atomic number or number of protons. For example, the atomic number for the element uranium is 92. That means that the uranium atom has 92 protons in its nucleus. A plutonium atom has 94 protons in its nucleus, so its atomic number is 94. Uranium is the key source material for nuclear weapons. No surprise there, but we're finally talking about bomb stuff. Before we get there, however, a few more important details about atoms. Yes, we're about to get to the heart of the matter. Yes, that was an intentional pun. Although the number of protons for a specific element is fixed, so for uranium, 92, the number of neutrons for the same element can vary. An element can occur in several different forms called isotopes, which have different numbers of neutrons. Isotopes occur because of certain types of nuclear reactions, processes in which two nuclei or nuclear particles collide, producing new products. For example, a neutron may collide with a nucleus of an element and can be absorbed, forming a new isotope of the same element. The chemical properties remain the same, but the atomic weight increases. Now we're going to talk about atomic weight. So isotopes, which are also called nuclides in the literature, they're identified by their atomic weight or mass, which equals the number of protons plus the number of neutrons. Electrons weigh so little they're not really considered for the mass or the weight of an atom. For example, the isotope uranium-235 has 92 protons, which makes it uranium, and 143 neutrons. The isotope uranium-238 also has 92 protons, but it has 146 neutrons. That means it's slightly heavier than uranium-235. Okay, we've already talked about how the number of protons in the nucleus of an atom determine its chemical properties. Uranium-235 and uranium-238 are the same chemical element. They have the identical chemical properties, but different atomic weights, but mass, again, is a physical property. Different isotopes exhibit different nuclear characteristics. For example, let's take hydrogen. Hydrogen is the first element on the periodic table. It has one proton, but its isotope, deuterium, has one proton and one neutron. Both of these isotopes are not radioactive. But there's another hydrogen isotope called tritium, which has one proton and two neutrons, and that one is radioactive. Okay, here it is, the climax of the story. The starting block for nuclear weapons is uranium, but not just any uranium. a particular isotope of uranium that is capable of nuclear fission. And that's the nuclear characteristic that allows for mass to be converted into energy. While the isotope uranium-235 can fission and produce energy and produce a nuclear explosion, the isotope uranium-238 cannot fission and produce a nuclear explosion. All right, that's the same element, but a different isotope. Lucky for us, uranium-235 is extremely rare and hard to make. Natural uranium, the kind that you can find in uranium ore in the Earth's crust, contains 99.3% uranium-238 and only 0.71% uranium-235. For comparison, weapons-grade uranium developed for the arsenals of advanced nuclear weapon states consists of about 90% uranium-235. So how do we get there? Stay tuned for future segments to find out. Thanks for listening to the Authors of Mass Destruction podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a review. You can also support my time in producing the show with Patreon at www.patreon.com/Natasha Bajma. For more information about the podcast, go to www.authorsofmassdestruction.com. See you next week!